this weekly podcast of Science and the City, the webzine of the New York Academy of Sciences, online at scienceandthecity.org, was produced in partnership with the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Today is January 26, 2007, and I'm Adele Caravanos. Steve Wozniak, co-founder and inventor of Apple Computers, is the author of iWAS, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. In this lecture at the American Museum of Natural History, Wozniak describes his childhood, his sources of inspiration, and the offbeat thinking that led to the Apple II computer.
I grew up on the West Coast, you know, and I was very distant from the East Coast, and being shy, never really wanted to deal with those East Coasters. They were like a different culture. And, I got early inspirations from books and TV shows and all that, that I was mathematical, I was electronic, and I knew my place in life. Well, I built my first ham radio out of things called vacuum tubes, which you probably, a lot of you remember well, and you'd basically buy a kit of parts and bolt everything together, and the tubes would glow and tune some dials, and you got your ham radio. But then what I would almost call the Big Bang of computers happened. And it happened out in New Jersey, AT&T. They invented the transistor. They discovered the transistor. And that was the start of it. Almost everything we have today in computer technology, in television, modern television technology, all the electronics of our lives really spring from the transistor. And really, all the chips we have are made of transistors on the inside. Well, William Shockley moved out to California, to Mountain View, California, when it was called Santa Clara Valley, full of orchards as far as you could see up to the mountains, just trees and trees and trees producing fruit. He moved out there and started a company to develop a certain kind of transistor, a difficult kind of transistor. And after a while, some of his employees split out because they wanted to develop the normal, simple transistor. They started companies like Fairchild and Rheem and Raytheon and a lot of companies that were sort of getting known in our area for making transistors. The same time, Lockheed Missiles and Space opened a division in Sunnyvale, California. And my father was an engineer, so we moved there in 1968, and there were a lot of engineers moving in to work for Lockheed. Well, turns out that not only were transistors very new and expensive and not sold in electronic stores, but the companies that were going to learn how to make several transistors on a chip were not going to be priced. Chips were not going to be priced anywhere near individuals. My dad, working for the military, where you launched missiles and every little fraction of a gram counted, was one of the few people close to the chip makers. These were the clients of the chip makers. So my dad took me to a show in San Francisco once, and I got to sit there where somebody, maybe it was Gordon Moore himself, pulled up a diagram that showed a bunch of building blocks connected with little roads, and he said, "This is a picture of a chip we're going to make with six transistors on it." Wow, I thought, my transistor radio has six transistors in it, most important possession of my life when I was 10 years old. And I said to my dad, I said, "Well, are they going to make chips so they can make better transistor radios for us kids at home?" And he said, "No, they really make chips for the military." And then after a few years, only the little lower level parts fall out and really become, you know, it work into people's lives, their home appliances and their home electronics and all. And that always kind of bothered me. I thought that, people in their homes are what we should care most about. I discovered by accident again, totally by accident, a journal of computer articles in my home. Articles talking about amazing things like a big TV screen and every little dot where the TV hit that could be white or not, every pixel could actually memorize its state and be sensed whether it was on or off, and then rewritten with the correct data, and it was a type of memory, and this just intrigued me. Anybody can of any age could understand it. Now, 1960 time frame, computer technology was beyond rocket science. You'd never see a computer in your life. They were those big buildings that were, researchers in certain universities researched computers, and the military built a few, but they weren't like normal, common things. So I was surprised. If this is beyond rocket science, how can a fifth grader understand this stuff? They started talking about ones and zeros and how you can add two zeros together and you get a zero. I thought, that's so easy. You add a zero and a one and you get a one. And the only trick was if you added two ones together, you got a zero and a carry. But it was a lot simpler than our mathematics with 10 digits. And I said, my gosh, I started writing numbers on pieces of paper and adding them up myself and saying, my gosh, this computer stuff is easy. You don't need higher level math like calculus and all. And I started, and I fell in love with it. And I saw some equations that looked like an algebra called Boolean algebra that would explain how you could change little circuits called ands into ors and vice versa and switch them around and design things different ways. And I thought, wow, this is all understandable. I love this. Of course, I'm never going to do it in my life. They don't have jobs in computers. They're just, it's only research, something that you never even hear about. We didn't have computer magazines or anything in the stores. We never saw them. And I thought, you know, when I grow up, I told my dad, I'm going to be an engineer like you. And second, I want to be a fifth grade teacher, like the teacher that you told me is so important in my life. And I said, are teachers paid more than engineers? My dad said, no. I said, oh, are elementary school teachers paid more than high school? He said, well, no. So, that was how I learned. But I still wanted to be a teacher. But I wanted to be an engineer first. And I thought being an engineer means you design things like televisions and radios, appliances with knobs like my ham radio. And that's what I would do in life. And computers was just something you did as a hobby for fun. Some things you do in life, you get the rewards that people can see. And supposedly that's your motivation. Extrinsic rewards, it's called. People can see if you get a grade in school, if you get a salary, if you get a job title, if you get lots of money and nice clothes and a house and a few yachts. They can see those sort of things. But the rewards you would get from the thing that's your pastime, the thing that you would do even if you weren't paid a cent for it, is the thing that you do on your own time without being paid a cent for it. Whether it's Sudoku puzzles or in my case, it was these little learning about computer logic. Science fairs were a big part of my life. Built science fair projects like a tic-tac-toe computer out of hundreds of transistors. Basically, you can break tic-tac-toe down into maybe 100 sets, 100 rules by which you can play the game. Maybe you can break it down, if you're really smart, into just a couple of dozen or a few dozen rules. And each rule, you hook up some transistors that decodes that one rule to decide where to make your move in tic-tac-toe. So it's a game of logic. Well, actually, technology is all based on logic, but I found out in later life that tic-tac-toe is not a game of logic. For example, I was taught that if you follow a set of logical rules, you can never lose at tic-tac-toe. And everyone would agree that that's true, logically. But actually, tic-tac-toe is a psychological game I learned in later life. You can trick people into letting you win. And that's the key to a lot of games. As I went on, I designed by eighth grade, you know, I thought, computers, what are computers? I was on this mystery search. What is a computer without being bold enough to go and actually look and find books and go to libraries and study computers? I just wanted to stumble into these beautiful things by accident and, you know, and know these little special things that a lot of the other electronics kids in my area didn't know. Sure, we'd hook up house-to-house intercoms with wires strung up and down the block and across the light poles and do the things that a lot of electronics kids did. It's amazing. When I tell the stories about the sort of projects that we built and crystal radios and ham radios and little amplifiers and tone makers, I run into people, a lot of people, even in New York especially. New York was the center of the United States for that kind of electronics. There was, some area near here called Radio Row and had all these electronic stores on it. So all across the country, I run into kids that were doing this kind of thing back then, more than today. And it was fun. But my little special thing was computers, because no kids did computers. No kids had this journal that was only put out for certain kinds of engineers like my father to learn about computers. But computers, one of the things computers do is they calculate numbers. So by eighth grade, I built a little science fair project with hundreds of transistors again that would actually add zeros and ones, do it the computer style, and display the answer in some lights. So you could take a number like 79 and look up on a little chart I made that 79 is 1010011. And you flip some switches up to that number and add it to something else, and you could look at the lights in the display and read off the result and figure out what it was. And And this was cool because I was getting closer to what is a real computer without asking. The next year, I went and I saw a project in a science fair that had a motor and a pointer. And a pointer went step, 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 step. It was a stepping motor. And it could go click, 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 click to all these different 20 positions. And each position, you could dial in a small little thing for this computer to do. And sometimes the computer, the motor, would back up, zip, and repeat a set of steps. Step, 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 step. Back up, zip, step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, back up. It was a loop. And then I sort of understood that's what computers do. They do one thing after another, and all the things that they do are very, very simple steps, like the adder that I built in my own science fair project. In high school, I was so advanced in electronics, I had a great electronics teacher, and he had the greatest electronics program, better than any of the local colleges. The equipment that he had managed to accumulate on almost no budget by having the early year students in that high school build various pieces of test equipment as their projects. By now, we had full oscilloscopes and meters and power supplies and signal generators. We had it all to work with in our stations at that high school. The teacher wrote all the lessons himself. I really came to admire that. He wrote them in an order where you would learn electronics. He didn't use a book that was pre-written. And you do a lot of calculating on slide rules. I was so proud of my calculating abilities. But I knew so much electronics already. After all, in sixth grade, I had had a ham radio license. And the teacher said, well, you know it all, so I've arranged that you can go down once a week to a company in Sunnyvale and program a computer. This is back when you never thought you'd see a computer. We didn't have a computer in our high school. Oh, my God, this was like the greatest thing you could ever have happen in your life. And so I got a book called Programming in Fortran, and I went down, and an engineer taught me how to punch out cards on a key punch, put them into a computer, and run a program. One of the early programs I wrote was called The Knight's Tour of a Chessboard. You know, I just basically numbered up an array of spots with eight rows and eight columns and jumped the knight around on numbers. You do it all mathematical with numbers. Jump him around until he can't go any further and back up. And you try to hit every square on the chessboard exactly once. Now, a computer was the most incredible thing ever built by man. A computer could do a million things a second. How fast can a human being do things per, you know, how long would it take you to do a million separate things? Even counting to a million. I mean, you couldn't imagine the time almost. But a computer can do it all in 1 second. This is incredible. Well, it sat there running my chess program, and it never came up with an answer. And it was the next week. I printed out chess boards and followed them, and I said, my God, this program is working perfectly. It's just it's going to take 10 to the 25th years to get a solution. So it didn't strike me right away then. I just thought I had a difficult problem. But really, in later life, you realize that being able to do a million things a second, the raw power of a computer, can't solve the complicated problems of our lives or even some simple problems that need the right approach. You really need sort of the human intellect for that. While I was down there programming that computer, I saw a manual called the Small Computer Handbook describing the Digital Equipment Corporation PDP-8 mini computer. I had no idea what mini computers were. But I saw the manual. They saw that I wanted it. They said, you can have it. And I took the manual home, and it described the architecture of a computer. The architecture of a building is, you know, how many rooms are there, where are the doors, what are the sizes of windows and that sort of thing. And the architecture of a computer is how many registers are there and, you know, how many bits go here and what are these instructions, these little tiny steps that a computer can do one after another after another. So I had a manual that had the architecture of computers, and I thought, I wonder if I could ever build a computer. Remember, I used to build tic-tac-toe machines with hundreds of what's called logic gates, and I used to build adders and subtractors. I wonder if I could take my knowledge and build a whole computer. And I started working out ways with chips. My dad would get me the chip manuals, and this is back in the day where you might find one little dinky adder on a chip. And it was very little, and it would cost $50. You know, that's hundreds of today's dollars. So no human being could really afford these chips. So I had a pencil and paper, which were free. And I just sat down, and I designed this computer real clumsy. Maybe a couple months later, I sat down and said, there's some new chips. I'm going to redesign the computer and use the new chips in it. I thought, wow, this will be a special little intrinsically rewarded, just a treat that I feel good about doing myself. I never had a friend at high school I could even talk to about doing this. I never had a teacher, and my dad wasn't into computers. I didn't even talk to him. I just shut the door and sat down with pencil and paper over and over and over and would design this computer with a little bit better each time, using newer chips, using fewer parts. I made a game out of it because I had enough free time and didn't have any social activities like parties going on in my life back then. I was you know, a nerd in high school, very independently minded, though. Man, you know, the world wasn't going to, you know, tell me who I was. I knew who I was, that sort of thing. And, you know, and I wasn't going to just do things because other people do it. I wasn't going to be a follower. You know, I was going to think things out. If it made sense in my own head, if my head could reason out, you know, a way to do what I was going to do in life or a way to a decision to make, that I trusted my own brain. Well, because I didn't, you know, want to do things the other kids were doing. It wasn't right unless you decided on your own to do it. I had a lot of free time, and I designed these computers. Now, a friend of mine and I learned that we could drive down. I needed to get more computer manuals to learn more about these mini computers. The mini computers of the day were the big rectangular boxes that looked like all the network gear in a radio station or a company, and they had switches and lights, and you could toggle all these switches into ones and zeros, and lights would flicker a little and push buttons, and nobody knew what the heck the front of a computer was. It's called a front panel. Nobody knew how to use it unless you were a computer person. Well, there were a bunch of these mini computers being made in the late 1960s, so we would drive to Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, where they had a technical library, where I might be able to learn more about computers. And we went there on a Sunday, so nobody would be around, and we wouldn't get caught because we didn't work there. And wherever smart people work, they tend to leave doors open. So we'd always find a door open to the main building. And we'd go upstairs to the second story technical library, and all these, there were computer books, but there were computer magazines. Open it up, and they're discussing new parts that are coming out, new computers, interesting articles to me, and little cards that if you filled it out and mailed it in, they would mail you back a manual describing the architecture of another computer. Computers from Varian Corporation, computers from Hewlett-Packard, mini computers from even IBM, mini computers from Data General. So I would order every manual of every mini computer, and then that weekend I'd sit down and try to design that mini computer with my knowledge of chips. So totally self-taught, no guidance, no books, no nothing. One day I got the manual for the Data General Nova computer, and I looked at it and I said, whoa, this computer has a way different architecture than all the others. It is so strange. It's pretty much, instead of 50 separate instructions, it has one long instruction that breaks it into about 8 different sections of little meanings. And I thought, whoa, this is weird. Well, when I finally went to design that computer, it came out to half as many chips as all my other mini computer designs. And I could never build these mini computer designs, but I liked to count the number of chips. That was my game. I praised myself if I could take a design that was 80 chips and work and work and work on a trick and use some chip that was designed for something else and cut it down to 78 chips. I saved 2 chips, and I just gave myself little bonus points inside. Nothing you could ever share with anyone. Nothing you could ever get a grade for. That was my thing. Well, I designed this new Data General Nova, and it was half as many chips. And I realized that the architecture of the computer exactly matched the chips that were made. And little things that were lines, in the instructions, I didn't have to design all this logic, this and that, or this or this other thing, and this and that, and invert complemented. I didn't have to go through all those normal design steps. I just ran wires straight to the proper chips, and it came together with so few parts. That was my favorite computer of my life. I told my dad, I was in my first year of college, I told him, someday I'm going to have a 4K Nova computer. I was so proud. He didn't know I did these computer designs even. And he said, well, how are you going to do that? It costs as much as a house. And that shocked me. I hadn't thought about that. And I said, well, I'm going to live in an apartment. So I kind of set it up. It's almost like a challenge. I am going to have a computer even instead of a house in my life. And that was a big step to take, but I just had to have one of these machines someday that could run a computer program. You needed at least 4K bytes of memory 4K computer to run a programming language like Fortran, the science language I was using in college. And you needed more than that. To have a complete computer that can run a programming language, you need to be able to type your program in on something. A card punch is pretty expensive and card readers, but they had teletype machines, big, mechanical, clunky machines that you see in the movies with the military, and they're typing on these big machines, and they're going clunk, 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 typing letters back like you see on the screens of movies like Hackers, you know, and that's a teletype, but it costs a lot of money, too, as well as the computer. But I was going to have mine someday. When I went off to my first year of college, they had a programming class, but programming classes were not for undergraduates then. So I had to take a graduate course. And I got an A+ in the course, but I thought, wow, I love writing programs. It's my thing in life. I wrote programs that would calculate all these special sequences of numbers that you find in the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics. Powers of two, inverse powers of two, Fibonacci numbers, factors of numbers, all these useful number things I would write. I had 7 programs. Each time I ran a program, it printed 60 pages and stopped punching out the cards to recontinue it for the next 60 pages. And the reason it only printed 60 pages was they'd kick your program off the computer if it ran too long. So I ran 7 programs 3 times a day, times 60 pages each, piling up just feet and feet and yards of computer printout in my dorm room. My roommate was getting a little pissed. And then they stopped running my programs one day. And that was a neat time. I even had them sometimes give me my output on microfilm. I learned how to if you just type in this one little number different in your program, it comes out instead of on paper, it comes out on microfilm. That was such a cool discovery. And, one thing that I learned was that, basically, for all of your input and output choices on a computer, you simply use a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and that determines, does it go to a printer, does it go to microfilm for output? It goes to any of a number of output devices. And for input, if it's coming off punched cards, you use one number. And if it's coming off of some terminal that you type on, you use another number. And so they just have 2 little numbers, 1 for your input and 1 for your output, and your programs work on that. Well, anyway, I had to go see the professor when they stopped running my programs. He turned on a tape recorder, acted like I was out to get him, and I didn't realize that they had budgets. And I had run our class 5 times over budget. I had run so many programs. And he was trying to make this point that it wasn't our class stuff. And I said, it's Fortran, and our class is Fortran. And he says, this is not our Fortran. And he called the computer department and told them that they should charge me. Now, that was the second highest out-of-state tuition for any university in the country, and this was going to be more than tuition. So I didn't try to go back to that school. The next year I was at a college in Cupertino, and a friend of mine had duplicated the computer room key. So we'd go in at midnight and work till 2 or 3 in the morning, running punch card programs through. He knew how to turn on all the equipment of the IBM 360 Model 40, and I would run my programs and get them working. And I just wanted to run programs anytime I could. I took every programming class they had, even ones that wouldn't carry transfer credit. That year of college ended, and I had a problem that some people have, which is I didn't have the money, and my parents didn't have it really, for a 4-year college. So I took a year working, and I'm one of those lucky people. I was so good at technology, at electronics, at computers, whatever. I never had to worry about a job. So I just walked into a company and got hired for a summer job and worked for a year programming a computer they developed. I was a little bit shocked when this computer got completely developed with operating systems and computer languages and programs galore, and it was a great machine, and the company went bankrupt because they sold a couple of them, but we went into a recession, and the people who financed the company didn't want to put more money in. And it was really sad to see a product get so well developed and go under. I went to Berkeley for my 3rd year of college, and there I took all graduate-level computer design classes. That was my thing in life. And while I was working, before going back to Berkeley, I told one of the executives how I used to design all these mini computers a few years before in high school. And I said I could never get the parts to build one, of course. They'd never give me the parts. And he said, well, if I get you the parts, can you want them? I said, sure. So I just sat down and designed a fresh computer of my own design, The executive got me the parts from a local company, including some RAM chips, and this is 1970. And I went down, and I went down to a friend's house, a few houses down, and we built this computer drinking cream soda. We called it the cream soda computer. Now, just like the mini computers that I had grown up designing in high school, it had a bunch of switches on the front that you could toggle to a 0 or a 1. Each switch could be 0 or a 1. You toggle in some data and push a button, and it goes into memory. You toggle some more data and push a button, and those zeros and ones go into memory, and the zeros and ones go into memory. Eventually, if you worked at it for half an hour, you could get a tiny little program into memory and run it. And that was the cream soda computer. Well, Bill Fernandes, who wired it with me, said, you got to meet this guy, Steve Jobs. He went to our high school. He likes electronics like you do, and he likes pranks. So, and I was known for pranks by then. So Steve came by, and we started talking about the pranks we'd done, about the electronics project we'd done. I told him how I designed all these computers, and we talked about life, and we talked about music, and became best friends for 7 years. So that was how we met. When I went off to Berkeley, Steve and I heard about this little device called a blue box that could put tones into a phone and make it dial anywhere in the world. It could control the phone company like a switching network. These blue boxes had been invented by engineers who were smarter than any of the engineers at the phone company, according to the stories you'd read, the lore. And it was just such an amazing world because you'd never believe it was possible. So I designed this little blue box, and Steve Jobs said, let's sell it. So we were actually selling them door-to-door in the dorms at Berkeley that year. And I'm sure got very close to getting caught and just managed not to get caught. So then after that year, I had totaled my car and I decided I'm going to work another year to earn the money for my fourth year of college. See, that's not dropping out of college. It's not flunking out. It's not saying college is worthless. I want to do other things. It's just simply earning the money. Very shortly after that, Hewlett-Packard had the hottest product in the world, the HP 35 calculator, the first scientific calculator that calculated engineer-type stuff, logarithms and exponentials and inverses and square roots and things. And that was the coolest product in the world. And I actually had managed to buy one of those for myself because engineering was my thing and I was the slide rule whiz. Well, they heard about me and they brought me in for an interview and I interviewed and immediately got a job offer as an engineer designing these calculators. What an incredible opportunity in life. So now I'm working at Hewlett-Packard, and that 1 year to earn the money to get back to college is going to turn into several years because Hewlett-Packard's too good a company to leave. I knew all my life that engineers were the most important people to me. I liked people who liked to build technical things out of parts. I wanted to be an engineer forever, and Hewlett-Packard was a company started by engineers, infiltrated by engineers up and down the org chart, and we were building the products that engineers use. Not only the calculators, we were building oscilloscopes and meters and power supplies and things. And these, so every single engineering team was had a good sense of what the market was for their ideas. So even the new products at Hewlett-Packard, right at the bottom, the engineers would come up with the ideas as well as marketing and the business from the top coming up with, here are the ideas that we should be working on for products. What a great company. How they respected engineers. I loved that company so much I'd never leave there for life. And I had no pressure to move up the org chart. I could be an engineer for life, which is what I wanted to be. I wanted to design circuits that did things for your hands and for you, so you as a person. And I wanted to write software along those lines. So I was so happy at Hewlett-Packard. And around this time, Steve Jobs graduated high school after we'd tried a couple of good high school graduation pranks. And he went off to, Steve believed, when I first met him, he was shooting movies of claymation figures where you move the clay a little bit to make figures move around in a movie, you know, which reminds you a lot of Pixar today. He was reading books about the few special people that really changed the world, the Einsteins and the Shakespeares and Isaac Newtons that really had different levels of thinking that took mankind to different places. And he always kind of spoke in a way that you could tell he wanted to be one of those people. He wanted to be around those people. He went to Reed College because they had a Nobel Prize winner in physics on the staff. And he wanted to be around that sort of thing. So I drove him up to college And for the first week of college, he just stayed in this tent in his dorm room with his girlfriend, and he never went to any of the classes they gave him. He showed me a list of the classes. He says, they want me to take this dumb stuff, you know, some English this, math that. And this. He says, I want to study Shakespeare and, you know, calligraphy and that kind of stuff. So but he's very persuasive as a person. So he can talk almost anybody and anything. They let him stay at Reed College without paying dorm or tuition. They let him stay a couple of years, hang around, just go to classes, whatever he felt like doing. And I was at Hewlett-Packard. I got involved in a lot of outside projects. Normally when you work on an engineering job, you come home, you want to drink a beer and watch a game. Well, I came home and I wanted to do my thing, which was neat electronics projects. I was lucky to get involved with some of the first hotel movie systems before anybody knew they would ever exist. Just lucked into so many things, early home pinball games. And I was in a bowling alley once. I also ran the very first dial-a-joke in the San Francisco Bay Area. I have to take credit for that because you've met a lot of – thank you. You have met a lot of people in your life who have started companies, but this is the only time you're ever going to meet someone who started the first dial-a-joke in a regional area. And the reason is, a dial-a-joke, you call a number and it tells you a joke. Sounds pretty easy, right? Sounds pretty simple. But back then, you could not own or purchase a telephone. Back then, you could not own or purchase an answering machine from the Monopoly phone company. You had to lease the one machine they offered, and it cost as much as my apartment rental. So that's why people didn't run dial-a-jokes. But it was so important to me, I was willing to give up the sacrifice a bit, and I ran dial-a-joke. And told a lot of good jokes, a lot of Polish jokes. And when the Polish people kind of got upset about the Polacks seeming stupid, I said, what if I switch them to Italian jokes? And they said, that's fine. Because that was before political correctness. So I'm doing all these great side projects. I walked into a bowling alley one night, and there's a Pong game, a little TV set playing a game. And before that, all you ever saw in your life was pinball games, whack, 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 you know, with the whackers on the side and balls going around, and they were kind of all about the same. And here's a little game with a TV set on a game on it. And I just was astounded. Who would have ever thought a television could display a game? Who would have ever thought somebody could design such a thing? And it was 25 cents to play, where the pinball games were 10 cents to play. This was shocking. I played a few games, and then I turned to my fiancée and I said, I can build one of those. Because you know what? I can't buy one. But anything I can't buy, if I have enough parts, I can build it. I know how to design my own stuff and get parts. Hewlett-Packard had a policy that if you something was your own design, you could have parts out of the stockroom with the approval of your supervisor. And they felt that your mind was benefiting and increasing from that experience. So that's great. So I went down. I knew television signals. I had a television at home. Televisions in those days didn't have video in. So you had to unscrew the back of the TV and take it off. And then probe around and make sure, you know, every once in a while you get shocked really badly. That throws you 4 feet back against a wall. Hardware people get used to that. Hardware people who fooled around with electronics in my time all got shocked pretty often in their lives. And so now I have this little tiny device I bought from Sharper Image that four people stick their fingers in these four little holes, and it goes beep, 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 with a light going around, and it slows down. Beep, 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 beep. And wherever it stops, that person gets a shock. Hardware people will gladly play that game. Software people say, no, I'm not touching that. It shocks you. That's how you can tell the difference. So at the back off my TV set, I figured out how to run wires and little circuits in and put video and get it to show up on my TV screen. So I built this little device with a bunch of chips, hooking little gates together that go zeros and ones and up and down, and making sure little pulses came out at the right time on my TV set to show up as balls and paddles. And I had a Pong game, and then I put in a couple of programmable chips that we use to develop programs for our calculators. Put a couple of those into my design so that when you missed the ball, it put a four-letter word on the screen, like heck or darn. And the engineers at Hewlett-Packard all loved this and kind of smiled. And it was very few parts. By then, Steve Jobs came back from Oregon, and he got a job working at the company that really made arcade games, video games, a part of the modern world. That was Atari, the first video game company for arcades. And he got a job working there, right in Los Gatos, the city I live in now. I'm so proud of that. And I'd go down there and see the new games they were working on, and he'd introduce me to the top people at Atari. They tried to hire me because they saw my little Pong game with very few chips. And I said, nope, I work for Hewlett-Packard for life. That's an engineer's company. I'm going to be an engineer for life. Can't never leave it. Well, Steve came to me a short time after that, and he said, Nolan Bushnell, the head of Atari, wants this game designed, a one-player Pong game. It was to be called Breakout. And it has these bricks and a ball bounces, and he describes it. And he says, could you design it? I said, could I? What a chance of a lifetime to be a part of, you know, games that people really play, a real product. And he says, well, there's one hitch. You have to do it in 4 days. This was back when that kind of design, games were not software. They took 6 months to build, at least. 4 days and nights. Sure, I was the whiz-bang designer and known for my designs, but I didn't know if I could do that. I said, I'll try. 4 days and nights. We didn't sleep. We both got mononucleosis, finished and delivered the game to Atari. So that was kind of a good experience. When you're in the sleepless state, your mind gets very creative, and a lot of ideas come to you. And one of the things I saw in there was Atari, we only used black and white TVs in that day for video games. Atari only used them because they were cheaper. But they had this little white dot moving on a TV screen, and they covered the screen with Mylar overlays that were green and blue and yellow and red. And this dot was flickering and changing colors as it moved around. I thought, wow, did they have a colored TV display? And they didn't. But man, it made me think color. I started thinking about color, and some weird idea popped in my head of a little $1 digital chip that if you just simply ran it at a certain speed, what came out of it was a signal that went up and down and up and down at exactly the same rate as color television signals do. Color television, a red goes up and down smoothly. My signal would go up and down real rough. And then if I delayed it a little in time, it might be blue instead of red, or delayed it some more. If I put different patterns into loading those little patterns of ones and zeros, I had 16 possible patterns, and each one would sort of correlate to a different color. Would it work on a colored TV? Or would it not work because it wasn't quite pure enough? I didn't know. Filed that thought away. Well, back at the next thing that happened, Steve Jobs and I together went down to visit an old friend who'd done blue boxes. He'd only been caught, I think, by the police about 3 times. I think he hadn't been to prison yet, so maybe he'd only been caught a couple times. And he's in a basement, and he's typing on one of those big mechanical teletypes. And he says, Steve, I'm talking to this computer in Boston. I'm playing MIT's computer in chess. What? This was the ARPANET, he explained. It was a network that connected about a dozen computers. He called a number at Stanford and connected through a slow modem. Modems in those days were 110 baud or 300 baud modems, whereas today a modem is 50,000. So these were very slow. All they could do was send words at a slow rate to another computer. When that computer sent words back to you, it might take 10 minutes to get one page out of a book. It was that slow. But anyway, you could play certain games. And he said, look at this. And he made it list a number of computers across the country. Berkeley. I can switch to Berkeley this way, or Stanford, or UCLA, or Santa Barbara, or Illinois. This was so intriguing. I stared at it just like at Pong, and I said, I can build one of those. I'm going to build one. I have to have this. In each case, I had to have my own. All I had to do was go back home and redesign a new circuit that, instead of putting balls and paddles on my TV set, would put letters of the alphabet, would put words on my TV set. The TV was the only free output device you could ever have. Now, what would I type on? I started going into Hewlett-Packard at 6 o'clock every morning, so I was ahead of everyone else, and I could read manuals undisturbed and looking for parts that might help me build this sort of device. And I found a keyboard that I could buy for $60. $60. Hundreds of today's dollars. The most expensive part of the whole Apple II project. And I came up with $60 and bought that keyboard and designed this machine. And the way it was designed was I could type on a keyboard, and my words went to the computer over a modem that I built to a computer in Boston. And when the computer in Boston talked back, it showed up on my TV set as words. And this was a little video home terminal. And it was so cool. And Steve Jobs saw it, and I didn't really need to use these computers very much. They had some files for guests, but I wasn't. To me, it was just building it. Steve Jobs came by, and he said it, and he said, there's a local time-sharing company called Call Computer, and they rent out to companies computer time, and they rent terminals, these big, huge terminals that cost thousands of bucks for a video terminal, or even a couple thousand bucks for a big mechanical teletype. You can build this thing for just a few hundred bucks. Why don't we sell it to them? So we actually sold a bunch to that company. That was the second time we sold a product. The next thing that happened was my friend Alan Baum said, there's a club starting up over in the Palo Alto area. We're going to meet in a guy's garage, you know, for the first meeting. And it's a club for people who build video terminals and things. Wow, I thought, man, I'm so shy, but I love to show off my good work. It's the only time I can socialize. If I show off a good design, people will talk to me. So I thought, I'm going to go to this club and say, wow, look at my design for a video terminal. It's so sleek. It's so few parts, and it works. And I went to the meeting and was shocked. The meeting wasn't about video terminals. It was about a thing called computers. They had these hobby computers. The Altair Computer Kit had been released, a big rectangular square box with a look cold like it belongs on a factory floor with switches that you could toggle in zeros and ones and push buttons to get data into memory. And it had some lights to show what was in memory. And, you know, just like my cream soda computer, little kits based on these new microprocessors that were coming down in price. And I said, whoa, the last few years I've been working at Hewlett-Packard, I totally didn't follow microprocessors at all. Now they're all of a sudden, you can buy a microprocessor, you can buy a little bit of memory at an affordable price, and you can almost have that computer. You can almost afford that computer I told my dad I was going to have someday. Well, I knew that night that I was going to have my computer finally in my life. I had to design it to keep it cheap. I couldn't afford to buy an Intel microprocessor because they weren't sold in stores. You had to go down to some distributor and sign up all these credit things like you were a company and had officers that dealt with finances. You had to, you know, and it was awkward. And it was $400 for a microprocessor. Where was I going to get $400? It was going to take me a while to save that much. And then as an employee of Hewlett-Packard, I could buy a Motorola microprocessor for $40. I was in business. And I said, here's the idea I came up with. I didn't design a computer from the ground up, which I could have done. I said, I already have a terminal that talks. When I type on my keyboard, it goes out to the computer in Boston. When the computer in Boston talks, it comes back to my television. What if I cut out the middleman, sort of? What if I cut out the computer in Boston and I just put a microprocessor and some memory, a little computer heart right here on the board, and I'm typing to my own computer, and it's popping up on the TV set? So it was a real makeshift product. Take something I'd already designed, add a little bit to it, and it will compute. And the same year, they introduced the thing called dynamic memories. The first time memory was going to fall into a range that you could have a 4K computer, that means enough of a computer to run a programming language, at a real human affordable price. And all these other computer kits that were being sold, batches of parts and all that, they used static RAMs. They weren't cheap enough ever to, you know, you had to be a company with a huge budget or nowhere to get your parts for free to actually build it into a computer that could run a programming language, which was Bill Gates BASIC. This name Bill Gates got known by our club. Now, the club that we attended grew to 500 members meeting regularly. We were low-level technicians who knew about computers. We weren't the people who ran companies. We weren't the high-up people who had a lot of money. We were the ones who wanted to be the programmer that was so smart that with this little computer of our own, we could be more important than the CEO. We talked about the social ramifications, how we were going to improve society so much, the world. Everyone was going to have their own computer and be able to do so much more than they ever had. They were going to be teaching children, and the 90% of our mind that's unused would be used. And we had all this revolutionary talk about a new world that was coming. The big computer companies said, oh, it's just a passing fad. It's going to go away. It's not worth anything. We're not interested. That's what Digital Equipment said. That's what IBM said. That's what Hewlett-Packard said. I had my little computer working by then. I had my computer working. I took it down to the club, and I would demonstrate it. During the second half of our club meeting, I would put it on a table with my TV, and people would watch me type data in, and little programs would start to run. So there was a crowd gathering around getting kind of interested. About this time, Steve Jobs started coming to the Homebrew Computer Club. He wanted to see what was going on, and he saw that, and he said, why don't we start a company to sell a PC board so they don't have to build their own computers? And by the way, I was giving away the schematics. I was giving away my designs. I was giving away my software listings. So anybody, I said, you can build your own. Here's the instructions. Everyone can have their own computer now at an affordable price. And Steve said, these people don't want to spend weeks wiring their computer together, soldering wire after wire after wire. Why don't we make a PC board for $20 and sell it for $40? We invest a few $100 to design a PC board, and then we make, you know, 100 of them, and we sell them. And if we sell 50 of them, we get our money back. And I didn't think we'd sell 50 of them at the club. And Steve said, we'll find other places to sell them. Besides, for once in our lives, the two of us will have our own company. Well, who could turn that down? It was so simple. You didn't have to leave a job. You didn't have to make too big a sacrifice in life, and you get to have your own company, actually making something. I said, whatever I design belongs to Hewlett-Packard. I'm sorry, I'm under an employment contract. So I went to Hewlett-Packard. I tried to get them to build this product. I described a little computer that you type a basic program on a keyboard, and it shows up on your home TV. I wanted them to do it so bad, and it would cost $800. And they couldn't justify that kind of a product because it was not an engineering product built to the quality standards engineers want. And it was fanciful. That was the problem. So they turned me down the first of five times. We didn't start a computer company, Steve Jobs and I. He came up with the name Apple Computer. I picked him up at the airport once and he suggested the name. And I said, wow, we kept trying to think of better names and we couldn't. I said, what about Apple Records? And he says, well, that's a record company. We're a computer company. So I figured, well, he knows what he's talking about. We formed this little partnership. Steve Jobs had 45%. I had 45%. Ron Wayne had 10%. And then one day, and Ron did our manuals and a drawing, a sketching of Newton under the apple tree, and he hand wrote our partnership agreement. He was really acknowledged and talented from his business days. Well, Steve called me at work one day after we made our first PC boards. I sold my most valuable possession in my life to make it, my Hewlett-Packard 35 calculator. I sold it for $500 to get the money to start this company. Steve sold a van that he didn't need very much, just he could walk. lived with his parents, you know. I got a phone call from him, and he said, are you sitting down? He said, I got an order for $50,000. Whoa, that was twice my engineer's salary. $50,000? What? Turns out that the local computer store, the one computer store in our area, had seen me demonstrating this product at the Homebrew Computer Club night after, you know, every couple of weeks when we had meetings. And they wanted to buy completely built computers. And this was the one that could be made into a completely built computer because it was so small. It was so few parts. It was all on one board. So now I got really scared. I had Hewlett-Packard's legal department check out every division of Hewlett-Packard, and they all turned me down. That was my second turn down of five at Hewlett-Packard, actually. So now we had a fully built computer, Steve Jobs, but we had no money. Absolutely. You know, we're in our young 20s, and we have zero money, no savings account, no nothing to draw on. You know, if my hi-fi hadn't been stolen, I could sell it. And so we're sitting there, and Steve called the parts suppliers. We needed the parts to build 100 computers. He got the parts on 30 days credit. And what we did was we had the computers built in Santa Clara. The parts came out of a closet at a certain company that built the computers in Santa Clara. Parts came out of the closet, and we had 30 days to pay for them. They got stuffed into the newly made PC boards and wave soldered there, and then we'd drive down and drive a bunch of them to a workbench that we set up in the garage. We didn't really run the company out of a garage. We didn't have a telephone there or anything more than one workbench, but it was close to our heart, this garage. Steve ran the company from his bedroom. He made the calls to the media to notify them of what we had and get publicity for us. He made the calls to the part suppliers. He made calls to stores telling them what product we could sell them. And I did all the designs at my Hewlett-Packard cubicle, so we really didn't do much in the garage other than put the computers down, see if they worked, and if they did, I fixed them, and we'd put them all in white boxes, and then we'd drive them to the store. So for 30 days credit on the parts, we got the computers, we got paid cash at the store in 10 days. So that was how we ran this thing with no money. Our partner, who had 10% of Apple, realized that if we ever didn't get paid, Steve Jobs had no money, I had no money, and they were going to come to him to get his gold nuggets. So he sold out his 10% for a few hundred bucks. Real shortly after the Apple I was out, I had thought about color when I first designed it, but adding color on was getting too kludgy. I said, time to design a computer from the ground up, a real Wozniak design. And that's where I designed the heart of it is a color generator for television sets. And then that one would drive microprocessors and memory. And I came up with some of the best ideas and best saving of parts and combining things in my life. I wound up with this computer, the Apple II, in about 3 months' time, and I could go down to the computer club and type a number into memory, a 5 into memory, and a blue square would pop up on my TV set. And then I could type a 7 into memory, and a yellow square would pop up. And anybody who knows anything about programming instantly can see that they can cause any color patterns they want on this TV. Nobody ever expected color in a small, low-cost computer. Nobody expected graphics. Nobody expected high resolution, meaning pixels on the screen. Nobody expected so many of the things. I put game commands into my BASIC. I wrote the BASIC myself so I could be sort of like Bill Gates, and I'd get a little bit famous for that. And I wrote the BASIC myself, and I could modify the BASIC and add commands for graphics and color. And we had quite a system, but we started realizing that this was not one to give away. We could sell 1,000 a month. The reason being, every computer before that Apple I, the Apple I was the one that I had a terminal that I used to type to a computer in Boston, and now I typed locally. Every computer before that had a front panel with switches and lights for zeros and ones and buttons to put them into memory, and they looked all geeky. Every computer from the Apple I on only had a keyboard, a human keyboard, and no front panel anymore. It had disappeared, just like with our calculators at Hewlett-Packard. We hid the computer. So that the Apple I was a big step forward. Well, the second computer to use a keyboard was the Processor Technology Sol using Intel chips, and it was selling 1,000 a month. Now we had the Apple II, 10 times better a computer than anything anyone had ever imagined, and we knew we could sell 1,000 of them, but they'd cost $250 each to make. We needed $250,000. We tried to talk to a couple of companies. One decided they'd make their own computer real cheap, Commodore. Another was too busy. Atari was too busy with their projects. And Steve Jobs, we walked into Commodore, and we're sitting there talking about, would they like to buy this maybe for a few hundred thousand dollars? And I just shut up my mouth because my salary was $24,000. And he's talking a few hundred thousand bucks, and I didn't expect that. It came out of, I didn't expect you could get that kind of money in life. So I didn't want it. Well, anyway, we didn't get those deals. We talked to venture capitalists, and we were in our young 20s with no business experience, so we didn't talk their lingo exactly, but they got us onto this angel, Mike Markla. Mike Markla was willing to put up $250,000. He studied. He understood what we had. He had retired from the rat race from Intel with a good stock option. He was very young. He wanted to do projects like computers in the home. And he realized the Apple II was really the one to start it all off. That was the one that was going to make it and make a $500 million company in 5 years. And then he said, Steve, you have to leave Hewlett-Packard. And he gave me an ultimatum day to make up my mind. And I went there and I said, no, because I'm going to be myself for life. And I said, I'm not good. I'm going to be an engineer for life, and I'm not leaving Hewlett-Packard. I've been at Hewlett-Packard for 1 year. I've designed two computers, cassette tape interfaces for data storage. I wrote a BASIC. I wrote all these graphics routines. I did all this incredible stuff. And why don't I just keep doing it on the side and keep my job at Hewlett-Packard for safety, for life, you know? And he says, and so I turned him and Steve Jobs down, and then Steve got my friends and relatives to all call me and implore me, please take this big money. Please do it. And finally, one friend called me up, a friend I trusted an awful lot and had spent a lot of my computer life with me, and he said, you can be an engineer and become a manager and get rich. Or you can be an engineer and stay an engineer and get rich. And it was really, I needed one person to say that second thing, that I could start this company and not have to run it. Because if I ran a company, I figured I would just get booted out. I wouldn't have the skills. And finally, one other person was saying, it's okay to start it and just say, I'm only going to be an engineer, period. And that day I left Hewlett-Packard and we started Apple. And we weren't that, the first product that we envisioned, storing programs on cassette tape. Read a program in for 2 minutes, beep, modify a couple of checks in your checkbook, and write the data out for a couple of minutes, beep. That was too slow a process. It was too awkward. That wasn't the computer that was really going to change life for everyone. We started selling some Apple IIs, but then along came a program called VisiCalc, the first Excel-like spreadsheet program ever. Small businessmen discovered that with an Apple II, an Excel program, VisiCalc program, they could change a few numbers month by month by month, and a few categories of expenditures, and see their business plan. And they could modify it and modify it and modify it and do more work in half a day than they could do in the rest of their lives. So they started buying. Our sales shot up 10 times all over the country. Small businessmen had to buy this Apple II with VisiCalc. Ours, there were three personal computers at that time. The Apple II, the Commodore PET, and the TRS-80. Each of those computers was completely built. Take it out of the box, turn it on, beep, and it's running BASIC, the formula I'd come up with. But the other two were non-expandable. They were not open. The Apple II was totally open to the world for plugging in extra hardware and extra software. We could add a floppy disk. We had enough memory. You could add enough memory, 48 KB on our motherboard. If you bought the Commodore PET, you were stuck with either 4 KB or 8 KB forever. Not enough for a floppy disk operating system. Not enough for a spreadsheet program like VisiCalc. So VisiCalc had to be written for the Apple II and no other. It was the first killer app and definitely made us a very extremely successful company. Thanks for listening.
Find out about all events taking place at the American Museum of Natural History and elsewhere in New York at our website, scienceandthecity.org.